I think you could go ahead and hook us up, Cassie.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. This is Julie Fedorchak. I'm chairman of the North Dakota Public Service Commission, and we are gathered here on the 12th floor of the state capitol. It is September 7th. It's about 10 a.m., and I'd like to call our regularly scheduled commission meeting to order. Okay. Well, in terms of opening comments today, I just wanted to highlight a couple of things and really as a reference to what's already occurred on the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I just wanted to emphasize for the reporters who are here some of this information, because I think it's important to remember what's been done and for you all to have sort of our record in terms of how we handled some of these archaeological issues. There's been a lot of talk about this in the news in recent days, and it's been concerning for me to hear others talking about various things such as 27 graves and cairns and 82 stone features that are apparently cited as existing within this route. So I wanted to talk about what kind of review was done on this route and make sure that all of you have those facts to weigh in your consideration of the other information that's being brought forward in recent days. So included in, and I just handed out to you, is a letter that sort of summarizes. It's a May 17th letter from the company, basically, that summarized all the SHPO correspondence. And the first page of that is a table that summarizes for us what they have received from the State Historical Preservation Office. We rely on the SHPO for their expertise in reviewing all of the archaeological and cultural resources and letting us know what needs to be protected and working with the companies to protect those or avoid those. And then ultimately what we look for in our permitting is the designation that no significant sites are impacted. And so this table summarizes what has been done there. I want you to remember from the hearings that the company did identified a 1 mile corridor for study. And this was the 1 mile corridor is for the entire route, and that's where they do the desktop analysis. So they evaluate all the resources, written resources that exist on that 1 mile corridor. And then they do that for environmental and cultural issues. Then they narrow it down, and in this case, they took a 400-foot-wide environmental survey corridor. That's 200 feet on each side of the center line of the pipe. And that's where they focus on the more extensive in-person surveys. So that's where they did their field surveys. And so they walk the route. The experts, both environmental and cultural experts, go out there and survey the entire route by foot. And that was conducted as well. And all those results are gathered up in their reports and filed with the State Historic Preservation Office. And there was many months of consultation that occurred between the company and the State Historic Preservation Office regarding those results. They identified 509 different cultural resources along the route, and through various means of avoiding them, changing the route slightly, or coming up with a mitigation effort signed off on by the SHPO, those issues, all of those resources were addressed. Also, you'll notice on the table, so that really gets into the North Dakota, the first couple of boxes, the North Dakota Inventory Volumes 1 through 3, and they signed off on that on February 19th as being acceptable. And then they had to do, where they've identified certain sites, they had to come up with mitigation plans for those. Again, that's the evaluation mitigation plan in February. SHPO identified that as acceptable. And then the unanticipated discovery plan. And that's an important piece that I really hope you will identify and cover a little bit here so the public understands this, that when you're doing field surveys, you can only see what's visible in the ground. So obviously, any construction project is going to turn over dirt. There's a chance that when you do that, you might come across something that's been buried. That's what the unanticipated discoveries plan is intended to account for and provide a plan for. If you come across things that are buried, how are you going to handle them? And that has to be signed off by the State Historic Preservation Office. Their plan for dealing with unanticipated discoveries is reviewed and signed off on by our state's top historical preservation officers. They then have to implement this when they're out on the site. They're obligated to tell us when they find something of that nature, and they're obligated to contact the SHPO. And really, construction halts, the most important thing is when they, if they were to come across a grave, for example, or something that might be considered a grave, they have to stop construction, and they have to bring in the archaeological experts to review that. Now, could the company violate that? They could. And if that's the case, that's a serious violation, and we will take that up, and we will be serious in some enforcement action on that. But those sorts of occurrences have not happened yet on this line, and we will definitely deal with them if they do, and we want to know about that sort of thing. But the company has signed off on and agreed to this unanticipated discoveries plan. This is very common. Every single one of our projects is handled the same way. They always have to have this because you never know what you're going to find when you start digging. And we want to protect these cultural resources as well. No one wants to be careless in how we're handling that. So, you know, in addition to looking at the stuff that the areas that the state is has jurisdiction over, the state SHPO also requested and did review all of the core land as well. And you'll see in the information that I have provided for you various letters from the State Historic Preservation Officer to the company that were filed with us that show that they reviewed and signed off on each of these items. So I just wanted to emphasize again, because there's a lot of talk about this, what was done, how this was handled, and what's been filed so far. And we can talk more about this in the Q&A at the end of the meeting. So that really concludes my opening comments, and I'd like to invite Commissioner Christman to go through. Yes.
Well, that was so thorough, and I commend you. I appreciated the update myself, and I've lived it. So I do really appreciate that. The only thing I would add, just from a perspective of people being dissatisfied with something that's occurring, you know, there are a lot of things that we do in life that we, where we get our way or where we don't get our way. And when we're not getting our way, you know, we can come to meetings and hearings. There's protests. You can boycott something. You can vote. There are many ways to express your desires. But what you don't do is trespass or threaten people or endanger people or vandalize things. And I guess my perspective at this moment is, long before I was in this job, I spent a couple years in the ditch working on a pipeline. It was a water pipeline, but kind of the same effect of laying them. They even are typically laid deeper to be below the frost line. And then a number of years at a county highway department, where sometimes you're on people's land that wish you weren't there, or things like that. And, you know, there's a lot of good folks out there working that don't deserve to spend their days and nights feeling threatened, or to feel like their lives or their health are in danger when they're out doing their jobs. They're just doing their jobs. And we should all step back and make sure that we are not threatening or vandalizing or trespassing when we're trying to express our will.
Thank you, Randy. I also want to open the door as well for follow-up from the reporters, as you're getting information from your sources out on the protest site, I'd encourage you, if it's related to anything that we've reviewed, please double check with us. We're happy to provide the counter, provide the facts from our perspective, and provide that information as well, because I do fear that there's a lot of social media use occurring out there, and before too long, rumors spread by social media become facts. And it's important to keep focused on the truth in this issue. And if there's differences in opinion in how we can handle the archaeological resources and protect them better, and how we can better protect the water quality, that's one thing, and we can deal with that. But we have to be talking about the facts and focused on the truth, or we will never find a resolution to this moving forward. So, again, we have worked very hard. Julie has pored over the record day in and day out on questions from, and please, if you have any doubts, give us a call. We're happy to dig through our volumes of information on this project and find you what you need.
Fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just add one point on the cultural things. One of the things that, you know, this process you're talking about, Commissioner's Torchak's talking about for this pipeline, it's the same for a wind farm, it's the same for a power line, it's the same for everything. And in this site, there was 509 archaeological sites found. One thing, because of the work in the energy industry, whether it's pipelines, power lines, or wind farms, our state now has a much broader picture of the cultural and archaeological resources out there. We found so much stuff out there because of the energy boom. So it's kind of interesting that when we talk about the awareness has really been expanded because of the growth of the energy, because these companies go out there and do these surveys in areas that have never been done before. So I wanted to highlight that point. And the last two things I'll talk about is, one is I've received an onslaught of phone calls this morning from Capital Electric customers about the rate case that they just had. So I wanted just to
the rate increase.
I just wanted to remind folks that we do not regulate Capital Electric. It's a co-op. And Stacy, I'm sure, will be getting phone calls, and it's certainly their responsibility. They're, of course, they get their power from Basin Electric. So if my members in the media haven't seen that yet, perhaps they might want to follow up. But anyway, and the last thing is, next week I'll be out in Minneapolis-St. Paul area for a OMS MISO meeting. I deemed early this year this would be the year of the power line, because the discussion still continues about who's paying for what and the different power lines, although we tend to be talking more about pipelines the last while. But I'll be out in that area next week talking, quite honestly, MDU and Otter Tail and a bunch of other things. So other than that, I have nothing else, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. All right. We have a number of items on consent, and I would like to move passage of those items.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Since seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. Okay. I have a couple pipelines on the agenda today. The first one is the an order. I move the commission adopt the order on recommended findings of fact, conclusions of law and order in Hess, North Dakota Export Logistics, LLC, 12-inch crude oil pipeline, Williams County siting application, case number PU-16-189.
Second.
This is a 1.1-mile 12-inch crude oil pipeline and associated facilities in Williams County. The hearing was held on this earlier this summer, and was held and was managed by the administrative law judge. This is a pipeline that is relatively short in its distance. It's a connector line. The maximum design flow rate of this project will be approximately 70,000 barrels per day, though, with normal throughput of approximately 50,000 barrels per day. And the project originates at the Hess-Ramberg truck facility near Tioga, and will terminate at a facility owned by Energy Transfer Partners, located approximately 7 miles south of Tioga. And the total anticipated project is about $4.5 million. On this project, the State Historic Preservation Office reviewed and concurred that no historic properties are affected. A number of other agencies were involved as well in the review: the Parks and Rec Department, the Water Commission, Game and Fish Department and others, the State Health Department, et cetera. There are no exclusion areas present in the survey area or avoidance areas present in the survey area. They will be crossing one water body, and they will be boring under this water body. It's an intermittent stream, and they'll be doing that in order to minimize the environmental impact in that location. All the easements needed for the construction have been obtained, and they have filed an emergency response plan, which they will incorporate into their other operations and follow. They participate in the one-call excavation system, and this pipeline will be constructed as set forth in 49 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 195, which you all know is the federal regulations regarding safe pipeline construction. So with that, this is another connector piece, a small pipeline connecting from the Hess system to the Dakota Access Pipeline system intended to transport this product through our state and onto Patoka, Illinois. And we're seeing more and more of these little connectors to this very sizable pipeline export system. And this is just one more of those. I think all the proper procedures have been followed in this case, and I will be supporting this order today.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. I move the commission deem the applications complete and issue a notice of filings and public hearing in Caliber Bear Den Interconnect LLC 12.75-inch crude oil pipeline McKinsey County siting application case number PU-16-420.
Second.
A public hearing on the applications in this case is scheduled for October 7th at 11:30 Central Time at Teddy's Residential Suites in Wofford City. This pipeline is a 5.3-mile, 12.75-inch diameter crude oil pipeline and associated facilities in McKenzie County, North Dakota. It is another connection pipeline to the Dakota Access Pipeline System. We will be reviewing this at the hearing on October 7th, and the public is invited and encouraged to participate in that hearing if they have any concerns or anything to offer in regards to this pipeline application.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Not to make too light of things, but I do find the name very interesting. Caliper Bear Den Interconnect. So that'll be one of the questions. They come up with all these interesting names. So we can keep it straight, I guess.
Let's run near a bear den.
I have no idea.
Is there any further discussion?
Say that. Never get that thing cited.
Or the remains of a old legendary location of a bear den.
Company's listening. We'll be asking that question.
Yeah. Must not be within the survey area.
Right. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay. Thank you, Darrell. That concludes my portfolio. Commissioner Christman.
Okay. RC1, I move the commission assess the proposed penalty for notice of violation number 1601 issued to Coyote Creek Mining Company, LLC, and issue a notice of informal conference in the matter.
Second.
Coyote Creek has requested an informal conference in the matter and also requested that the violation be vacated. Since an informal conference has been requested, a proposed penalty needs to be assessed, and the Reclamation Division recommends the Commission assess a proposed penalty in the amount of $2,500, and I'll explain how they came to that recommendation. During a routine inspection on July 12th, one of our inspectors noted significant erosion along portions of the Mine Hall Road and associated sediment deposition on undisturbed off-permit areas located down gradient of the Hall Road. The erosion and sediment deposition was attributed to storms on July 3rd, 9th, and 10th, and a follow-up inspection of the area was conducted on July 18th, and then by that time additional rainfall had been received on the 16th, so there was some additional erosion. Kyle Creek had implemented erosion and sediment control measures along this section of Hall Road. The Hall Road crosses several deep drainages, and it consists of a series of cut and fill segments. The Hall Road and associated ditches occupy nearly the entire permitted Hall Road corridor, thus creating limited areas for water management features. Many parts of the road were constructed with materials that have proven difficult to establish vegetation on. Portions of the corridor have been seeded several times this spring and early summer in an attempt to establish cover, but generally the cover on these areas was sparse. Erosion control measures such as small sumps, silt fences, and rock or erosion control blanket line channels were also utilized. The violation was issued for sediment deposition on undisturbed off-permit lands. So the required remedial actions include stabilizing the area, providing long-term slope stabilization of the Hall Road, and improved water management structures or systems from all Hall Road discharge points. An action plan is also required, and Coyote Creek evaluate the off-permit areas of sediment deposition on undisturbed areas in coordination with the property owners and develop a mitigation plan for dealing with these areas. So prior to the receipt of the NOV, Coyote Creek had begun repair of erosion features and stabilization of the Hall Road. In addition, they received approval to haul in topsoil from the Coyote Power Station to place a veneer of topsoil on the Hall Road slopes to enhance revegetation. Coyote Creek has requested an informal conference in this matter and asked the Commission to vacate the NOV, but since an informal conference was requested, the Commission needs to assess a proposed civil penalty because that can also be contested at the informal conference. And in doing that, the Commission must consider four factors in determining the amount of the civil penalties. These are the history of previous violations, the seriousness of the violation, negligence, and good faith in attempting to achieve rapid compliance. And I'll look at all four of those. We can assess a civil penalty of up to $3,500 per day for a history of previous violations. Generally, the history of violations within the preceding 3 years is considered, and a penalty for history has not been recommended in the past if three or few violations have occurred in that three-year period. And based on the criteria we've used in the past, Coyote Creek does not have a history of violations that requires a penalty to be assessed. Secondly, the seriousness. We can do a civil penalty of up to $3,500 per day based on seriousness. The violation did cause an adjacent, undisturbed, off-permit area to get sediment on it. We estimate that's about 3.25 acres have been affected. So a penalty for seriousness is warranted, and they recommend $3,000. We can also assess a civil penalty of up to $3,000 per day based on the degree of the fault of the permittee. And in this case, Coyote Creek had implemented erosion and sediment control plans for this area, but they were ineffective for the intense rainfall events that occurred in July. And although the erosion and sediment control measures failed, Coyote Creek was diligent in the installation and maintenance of those controls prior to the rainfall events. So a penalty on negligence due to lack of diligence and reasonable care is not warranted in this instance, according to staff's recommendation. And finally, for good faith, the commission can deduct up to $1,000 per day from the total civil penalty when the permittee takes extraordinary measures to abate the violation in the shortest possible time. No deduction can be made for normal compliance. Promptly began repair even prior to getting the NOV, so therefore a deduction for good faith is warranted. Staff recommends $500. So in conclusion, the Reclamation Division recommends that we assess a proposed penalty for this NOV in the amount of $2,500, which is $3,000 for seriousness, minus $500 for good faith effort, and hearing with an administrative law judge is being scheduled for November 3rd. And the ALJ will preside and prepare an order for the commission.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC2, I move the commission issue the order reinstating warehouse license number 1063 to Flasher Farmers Union Grain and Oil at its Flasher, North Dakota grain warehouse, effective August 25th, 2016, in case number GE-16-587.
Second.
On June 6th, we received cancellation notice on Flasher Farmers Union Oil's warehouse bond. The cancellation date was September 6th. Replacement bond was not timely filed, and their license was suspended effective August 6th, which would be 30 days before that bond ended, as appropriate. So they then had until September 6th to procure and file an adequate bond or submit a written request for hearing. On August 25th, they filed a bond issued by Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company. The liability on the $162,500 replacement bond commenced on August 9th. So staff recommends the commission reinstate the license issued to Flasher Farmers Union Grain and Oil effective August 25th, which is the date the new bond was filed with the commission.
We have a motion, a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC3, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-16-596, granting the request of Patterson Grain LLC of Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, to operate a 3,521,000 bushel grain warehouse at Botno, North Dakota.
Second.
Commissioner called Botno is up kind of north of Minot there.
East of Souris.
Just wanted to make sure you were aware. Thank you, sir. Okay. Patterson Grain is nearing completion of its Burlington Northern Santa Fe shuttle train loader facility in Botno and anticipates this warehouse will be ready to receive grain by the end of September. The warehouse consists of 2,012,000 bushels of permanent storage and 1.5 million bushels of bunker storage. Patterson Grain projects it will purchase 10 million bushels of grain annually at this warehouse. They filed 1,072,000, and that's an important number here because there's a kind of a, seems like a discrepancy, but it's not. So $1,072,000 grain warehouse bond. The required minimum bond is determined by the total physical capacity license in the state, the length of time the licensee has been licensed, the annual grain purchase of volume, and their scale ticket conversion policy. I'm not sure if this is the first of these, but there haven't been too many. So they also filed a policy that provides conversion of scale tickets within 10 days of grain being delivered. So that conversion policy, which was a new option in the law that, we promoted last session, reduces the required bond by 30%, and the required minimum bond is $778,050. I can't really explain why they did a bigger bond, but they chose to, so that's certainly give them additional coverage. In January, the commission approved their license application to operate as a roving grain buyer for the purpose of soliciting grain for delivery to this new facility once construction was completed. That roving grain buyer license was issued, and they've now notified us they have not operated as a grain warehouseman in the state, so statutory compliance has been met, and staff recommends a license be issued.
We have a motion and a second. Is there a further discussion?
I just want to compliment you on the efforts you put into developing the formula for how we can come license some of these larger facilities or all the facilities and offering that incentive for the conversion policy, which we know is probably the number one way to reduce the number of claims that you have in an insolvency, if there is an insolvency. So I'd love to see the companies using that, taking advantage of it, and making an effort to have that be part of their policies and the way they operate with their customers. And that incentive that was your idea to get them to do that was really really a step in the right direction. So it's great to see them using it, and I wanted to compliment you for your good work on that because that was all your idea.
Well, thank you. I think it was a good move in the right direction here. So.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Should also commendations to staff for working through the much more complex formula now. So appreciate that.
More effort, for sure.
Okay, RC4, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-16-609, granting the request of Anchor Ingredients Company, LLC, to operate a 50,000-bushel grain warehouse at Mohall, North Dakota.
Second.
Anchor Ingredients of Fargo filed a license application to operate a warehouse at Mohall. They will receive flax and lentils during harvest at this facility. Anchor Ingredients informed the commission that it has not transacted business as a warehouseman at this location. So statutory compliance, including the filing of a $416,000 surety bond, has been met, and staff recommends the license be issued.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I would add that Mohall is the hometown of the longest-serving attorney general in North Dakota history, Mr. Wayne Stengem, and interestingly, he breaks his own record every day. and also,
he counts so many places as home, I actually lost track that it was Mohall officially.
Interesting, if anyone knows where the name Mohall came from. It was named after a man named M. O. Hall.
Oh, funny. Wayne, even on the campaign trail, counts the home of where his dog was born. Personal connections to Valley City because his dog was from there.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC5, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-16-610, granting the request of Alliance Valley Bean, LLC of Larimore, North Dakota, to operate a 10,000-bushel grain warehouse at Fairdale, North Dakota.
Second.
Alliance Valley Bean is establishing this license at Fairdale, and it consists of just two 5,000-bushel bins to receive dry edible beans during harvest. The beans will then be moved from Fairdale to their licensed warehouse in Larimore. Harvest is underway, and Valley Bean had asked that a license be issued as soon as possible. I did sign and date a temporary approval. Statutory compliance has been met, and staff recommends the regular license be approved.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I don't have any discussion on this item, but I just was reminded we've got our grain storage numbers put together. We should get something out on that because we talked about it, but I don't know that we ever did that, did we?
We're working on it.
Okay. Fair enough. Because I know that Dave Thompson and Bo want those numbers quickly.
Right.
I'm just intrigued because I've heard a lot about variation of what the crops are in the state right now and what might actually be requesting storage and what might actually be coming in because it's going to be an interesting year out there.
It's important stuff, and without giving anything away, the numbers are going to be very interesting. Get that done. I'd also...
You know, it's open information they can ask for right now.
Yeah. It'll be more interesting if they wait till it's all compiled. So,
yes.
I would also...
Far better story.
Want to point out that Fairdale up in Walsh County is the home of legendary Bismarck State College wrestling coach and dance teacher and esteemed member of that awesome freshman class of the North Dakota State Senate of 1994, Ed Roy Kringstad.
He was a very talented dance instructor. I can attest to that.
Darn right.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC6, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-16-608, canceling warehouse license number 462 issued to Farmers Elevator Company of Cooperstown at Cooperstown, North Dakota, and ordering the business at Cooperstown is discontinued.
Second.
On August 22nd, we received a request to discontinue business there from the Farmers Equity Company of Cooperstown. This is a North Dakota cooperative with an original file date of November 16 of 1917. The licensee is merging into Finley Farmers Grain and Elevator Company, who will assume all grain inventory, grain obligations, and credit sale contract obligations. Farmers Elevator of Cooperstown asks that its request to discontinue business be approved effective September 1st, the date of the merger. I did sign and date a temporary approval, and so staff recommends that the regular request be approved.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC 7, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-16-613 granting the request of Finley Farmers Grain and Elevator Company to operate a 1,235,000 bushel grain warehouse at Cooperstown, North Dakota.
Second.
In August, we received the application from Finley Farmers Grain and Elevator to operate this warehouse at Cooperstown. They will assume all grain inventory, grain obligations, and credit sale contract obligations. Finley asks that the grain warehouse license for Cooperstown be effective September 1st, the date of the merger. I did sign and date a temporary approval. Finley is a North Dakota cooperative with an original file date even older of October 25th, 1911. And they'll have a combined capacity of 4,144,000 bushels and filed a $980,000 bond.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC 8, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-16-623, canceling facility-based grain buyer license numbers 2109, 2110, 2112, and 2113, respectively issued to Souris River Cooperative at Russell, Newburgh, Kramer, and Lansford, North Dakota, and ordering that business at Russell, Newburgh, Kramer, and Lansford is discontinued.
Second.
On August 15, we received the request to discontinue operating at these four facilities. Souris River is merging into Botano Farmers Elevator, and the merger includes a name change from Botano Farmers Elevator to Border Ag and Energy. Border Ag and Energy notified us it is assuming all grain obligations and credit sale contract obligations. Souris River asked that its request to discontinue business be effective. We approved on September 1st, which is the date of the merger. I did sign and date a temporary approval, so staff recommends that this request be approved.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
RC9, I move the commission issue an order in case number GE-16-622 granting the request of Border Ag and Energy, Botano, North Dakota, to operate as a facility-based grain buyer at Newburgh, Russell, Lansford, and Kramer, North Dakota.
Second.
So Border Ag and Energy is assuming all of Souris River Cooperative's grain inventory and grain and credit sale contract obligations. Souris River merged into Botano Farmers Elevator, and the merger includes the name change to Border Ag and Energy, as I said in the previous case. Border Ag and Energy, since they take it over, they remain a North Dakota cooperative with an original file date of February of 1939. With the addition of these facilities, Border will have seven facilities with a combined capacity of 10,012,000 bushels, and they have a $770,000 facility-based grain buyer bond on file. They asked that the license applications be approved effective September 1st, again, the effective date of that merger, and I did sign and date a temporary approval. So statutory compliance has been met, and staff recommends the license be issued.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I will just point out this and a number of these cases. I've been trying to point out ever since there was some discussion from another state agency with backdating something. Not really sure how to handle these sort of calling special meetings at the stroke of midnight or something so that operations can be seamless when they have these mergers or things like that. And so we're dating things, I think, very appropriately. And I'm signing temporary orders and pointing that out, and so we're, that's why I have begun pointing that out, and trying to emphasize the seamlessness of it. But we're not backdating something and that didn't exist for a period.
So. You're reviewing it, signing the temporary temporary permit, and then we review it again and vote on the whole thing.
And those things aren't done until we have all the the things that we need here to meet statutory compliance. It's just that then we're bringing it to a regular meeting some days later.
Yeah. So it's more of a result of us not having meetings, but for every other week that we have to do it like this.
Correct. And so I'll continue to point that out with those date issues.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
In RC 10, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-16S627 granting a request of Redwood Energy Company, LLC of Mission, Kansas to operate as a roving grain buyer in North Dakota.
Second.
Redwood Energy projects it will purchase 100,000 bushels of grain annually in the state and filed a $50,000 surety bond. They notified us that they have transacted business as a roving grain buyer in the state, but it does not owe any money for grain purchased in North Dakota. And they told staff, Redwood told staff it was unaware a license was required because it purchases grain only from licensed entities. So they found out of the requirement and notified us, and at this point statutory compliance has been met and staff recommends that the license be issued.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? I see none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
If I could, I missed on a previous case in Cooperstown. I ran into a story of an interesting gentleman named Dick Johnson, who hailed from Cooperstown, who was a test pilot for Convair Company, which ultimately was divided up, I think, and became parts of McDonnell Douglas and Lockheed, and very famous test pilot buried out in Arlington Cemetery back many decades ago, but with some of the original rockets and high-speed aircraft.
All right. Thank you, Randy. Commissioner Culp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have three items. And since Randy brought up the space travel, I just want to remind folks that John Glenn, the Marine, was the first man in space. So just so you want to close that loop. Okay.
Marines are spacey.
Whatever it takes. We'll be the first there. We're out in orbit most of the time. All right. Item BK1. I move the commission assess a filing fee of $10,000 and issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in Montana Dakota Utility Company, a division of MDU Resources Group, Inc., 115 KV Transmission Line, Dickey County, Public Convenience and Necessity, case number PU16538.
Second.
Thank you, Randy. In July of this year, MDU filed an application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct approximately 15 miles of 115 electric transmission line from an existing substation at Ellendale to the South Dakota border. We also note that MDU filed a revision to this August 31st, so we actually had this on agenda a few weeks ago for a 9-mile construct, but basically the company went out, looked at the route again and modified it to 15, so that's why the 15 miles instead of the 9. Comments and requests for a formal hearing must be received by October 11th. If anyone wants a formal hearing, otherwise the commission can decide this at an informal. A little more about this project. This is a 115 line that's going to be used to shore up reliability down that Ellendale area into South Dakota that's going to result from the major transmission line that we cited from Ellendale to South Dakota, that 345 KV. So it's a reinforcing the grid down in that area, a total of 45 miles in North Dakota and South Dakota, approximately 15 miles in North Dakota. Total cost, about $17 million. The cost of the North Dakota portion of it, $5 million. So transmission build-out continues in that part of the state, and I do believe we're going to see more wind farm development down in that area, because once we shore up the transmission grid down there, it's just a matter of time till we see more wind farms in that area, because it's so rich in that type of generation. And just look forward to, if anyone wants a hearing, otherwise we'll more than likely go through this in informal.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. Item BK2. I move the commission issue a notice of filing, notice of informal hearing, and notice of opportunity for hearing, and reduce the filing fee of $10,000 in Great Plains Natural Gas Company's gas transportation Pro Gold, case number PU16604.
Second.
Thank you. In August of this year, Great Plains Natural Gas Company filed for approval of its long-term transportation service agreement for Pro Gold. GP proposes to increase the per decatherm charge to Pro Gold for natural gas transportation service. Upon Commission's approval of the agreement also mandates an additional per decatherm increase beginning January 1st of each year from 2015 through 2018, excuse me, through 2027. There are numerous issues that we need to consider. Comments and requests for a hearing must be received by October 16th, 2016. I was trying to refresh my memory, and I don't recall ever doing one of these since I've been on the commission, as far as being this unique, this specific. But what we really have is, of course, Great Plains Natural Gas is a company that we have regulatory authority on, and Pro Gold, just a little background, Pro Gold is the owner of the facility, which is a corn wet milling plant down in the Wapton area. The facility is currently being leased by Cargill, so the information as far as the cost of this has been requested to be trade secret, so therefore I'm not saying what the cost is going to be. And as we get into potentially an informal or a formal, that'll be one of the things that I'm sure that each of us can look at individually. But it is a it is something that we have jurisdiction on. It is almost a very, very specific business relationship. But I do look forward to the seeing the official record developed and looking forward to the informal and asking questions that are appropriate to this case.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I'm just curious about this, Brian. Has Pro Gold negotiated this agreement with them?
I believe it's a negotiated agreement. Both parties are in favor of it, and we just have to review it because we need to look at it. And if we think something's not fair for one party or the other, then we, of course, can tweak it a little bit. But that was one of the questions I asked staff right away on that. So it should be a relatively straightforward discussion because it's a negotiated rate. And my thought process is that if one side couldn't get what they wanted, they would walk away from it. Victor just walked in. Did I explain that correctly, Victor? Make sure you grab a mic there.
It was a negotiated agreement between Great Plains and Pro Gold.
And we're required to approve those.
This is a little bit of an odd scenario. Generally, the agreements kind of fall into the tariff and rate structures that are in place. This one doesn't.
Okay.
We did approve. So there was one in place up until just this year that was approved in 1995, I believe. 94, 95, one of those 2 years, by the commission at that time. So it's definitely an oddity. It's not something that we've...
But it's based on the structure and the potential change in cost. So I'm guessing that Pro Gold is going to pay more. So that's where we'll get into the trade secret amounts and whether we think it's fair and reasonable. And
all right.
Correct.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
All right, thank you, Daryl. My final item for today, item BK3. I move the commission adopt the order on consent agreement and Public Service Commission, City of Granville, Pipeline Safety Enforcement, case number GS15723.
Second.
Thank you. I'm going to just take some time to go through this, but let me go through the actual order. On September of 2015, the PSC Gas Pipeline Safety Inspector conducted our standard records audit of the pipeline system in the city of Granville. As folks may know, they operate a liquefied petroleum gas distribution system in the city that is owned by the city. I should note that this is one of a kind. This is the only place in North Dakota where you have a city that owns the facility that provides heat to, quite honestly, the school and members of the city. There was one at one time that was operated in Headinger, but since that time that MDU has picked up a larger role in that. But this is a one-of-a-kind. And our inspectors basically identified four probable violations in their inspection of 2015, dealing with basically the city did not check the appropriate valves as required under CFR 49. They did not do the right cathodic protection review. They did not have the right pressure testing in place. So they had some some errors that were considered that were very significant. And quite honestly, this is not the first time that the commission has dealt with the city of Granville. It's I think we found 1988 there was commission action dealing with the city of Granville. More recently, in my time, in 2011, our inspectors found some discrepancies up there. We issued out a consent order almost where they agreed to fix things. We suspended the fines at that time because the city could not. We found that they had a financial hardship if they paid the fines. The fines at that time were $12,000. The next year, quite honestly, in 2012, our inspectors found some other errors. In that case, we did not suspend all the fines. We did fine them $1,000 and had, quite honestly, the mayor come in and quite a cast of characters in 2012 and said, listen, what are you folks doing up there? Because the commission never wants to go in and shut down a system, but you can't be operating a system that's not running safely. And so the since that time in 2012, things have gone pretty well up until the 2015 inspection. So over the last year, our inspectors have worked with the city of Granville to basically get them into compliance. But as a result of the probable violations, our staff recommended $30,000 in fines to the city of Granville. Now, we do talk a lot about potential fines for call before you dig, and there's a cap on those. But now for the civil penalty for violation of this type of law, the fine can be $200,000 for each violation that cannot exceed $2 million for any series of violations. So the playbook of fines for violations of gas systems is much different. It's very large. And so the staff recommended the $30,000 in fines. But in a discussion between the city and our inspectors, they basically worked out between the two of them a consent order that the city would agree to fixing all these problems by September 1st. And if they would do that, the consent order basically reduces their fine to $3,000. Now, yesterday, and I will say yesterday because we did have an informal with the city of Granville. We had the mayor of Granville, Corey Long, was here, as well as Nita Trainer, the auditor of Granville. We had very, very good discussion about the state of their system up there and basically what are they going to do that is going to not have them be found in violation as well as enhance the safety of it, because they've been in here before. What is it this time that's going to be different? And I did sense a marked difference in what the city has prepared this time as part of the consent order. First off, the violations that they found, the city has corrected as part of the consent order. Those are all taken care of. Our inspectors have verified that. Craig is sitting over there if there's any detailed questions. But the city of Granville is in complete compliance as of right now. But what has changed now is before, they basically have one individual up there that's their city guru, and he shovels snow, and he does the roads, and he operates the gas plant. He's a jack of all trades. And he is, in the past, it's been hard for them to keep that individual for a lot of reasons, similar to us keeping our pipeline inspectors. Once they get fully trained, we tend to lose them. We've, knock on wood, resolved that problem with the PSC with some changes. The city has a bigger commitment to keeping this individual, as well as they've subcontracted out a backup company, if you will, that if their inspector cannot do the required task because he or she is not available those days or he ends up leaving, they have a contract in place. And the contractor that works, that has been hired for them, also does work for other companies in North Dakota. Quite honestly, MDU is one of them that was cited in the informal. So what is different in this case is I think we have a much more proactive mayor and city auditor than I've seen them when they were in here in 2012. We also have a backup plan in place for if their individual for the city is not able to do those or if he ends up leaving for some time. So I think that this consent order today, I'm certainly going to be supporting it. I do have concern about the long-term viability of this because it's been such a challenge with the city of Granville. And hopefully after this motion passes, we have a pie meeting with MDU this afternoon. I'm going to open up the discussion with them to see what we can do to help the city of Granville perhaps figure out a long-term solution that they can afford that is also fair to the other companies that are out there. Because it's a challenge. They have a system that's getting smaller and smaller. It's been hard for them to keep up with the actual charging the cost of what it takes to run that facility to their very small pool of customers. But these are all secondary concerns to the safety of running the facility. So I think today's consent order is very much appropriate. I think our folks have done a nice job. This is levying a $3,000 fine. So we are suspending a large portion of the fine, but it is an increase over the fine that they received in 2012. And the discussion yesterday from the mayor and the city auditor, this will put a bite on their revenues for the city to pay this fine. But I think, speaking for myself, that you can't just suspend everything. I mean, there has to be accountability. They have to take this serious. They are. But I think the $3,000 fine they're going to need to pay within 10 days, they'll hear from their constituents on that. And also the city has set up a discussion with their members of the city about what are the citizens of Granville, what's their commitment to keeping this facility owned by the city, because there will be a cost to do this, because the cost of operating these types of plants has increased over the last few years, and they have to maintain it. That's all there's to it. And so I appreciate the informal yesterday. We could have perhaps did it without an informal, but I thought the informal was very good to get the key players from the city down here. I thought the questions that the three of us asked were very much on task. And I look forward to the continued discussion with the city and others about how we can help them run this system appropriately. And I think everything today is in order, and I look forward to moving on to the next chapter.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Well, I want to thank Brian for urging the commission to have that one-on-one discussion with them and bring those folks in to talk in person, because that was really valuable to be able to really emphasize to them the importance of following the rules and being compliant with the rules. I do feel like they very much understand that, understand the risks that are involved to the community if they don't follow the rules, and also want to give some credit to our staff for identifying these issues and being there, frequently to work with the city to make sure that this is safe. I think the most important piece for me is that they have the seamless plan now that allows for proper handling of this system, regardless of who the mayor is and who the city auditor is. They have to have this, recognizing that those personnel are going to come and go. But if you're going to operate a system like this that provides propane to people's doorstep, it needs to be, safety needs to be really a high priority, and it does come at a cost. And so it's important for those citizens there to understand as well that those costs aren't static. They will have to keep investing in the system to keep it safe and up to date. And that's a pretty significant burden for a system that only has 123 customers. But I give the city credit for wanting to continue doing that and finding alternative ways to meet those needs for their citizens in the future if some sort of an arrangement can be made.
I would also like to point out on this, I think Commissioner Kalkin made a good point that the mayor and the auditor, I think, really get it and what we're trying to do here. But I do know also in political subdivisions, it's not always easy to persuade the constituency. And, the constituency may not want to relinquish something that's been there a long time and they see as a good asset, but also have an unwillingness to invest what's necessary in it. And sometimes it's hard to make people understand the importance of certain regulations. And so I guess I seek help in this as far as any stories that might be written or aired about it. But, the people of Granville need to recognize these aren't regulations that are, out there to try and maintain a consistent paint theme throughout the city or something like that. These are regulations that are required in order to keep people safe. This is life and death stuff. If that system isn't operated correctly, a bunch of people can be killed from it. And so it's really important that they understand that. And when they're making their decisions on the long-term future of their gas system, they need to understand that these regulations are really important, and it's for their safety, not for any other less important reason.
Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
That concludes my portfolio, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. Well, that concludes our regular agenda, and I think we can open it up for any questions.
I just have a couple of real quick ones about...
Craig, don't wander off too far, right?
Okay. For Commissioner Crispin, or maybe for Commissioner Kalk, how many elevators are there in Bodno?
This will be two.
It will be two.
I was back home, I don't know, a few weeks ago, and this is a major facility that is basically down the rail line, probably a half mile from the existing Botno Farmers elevator. And this facility is I don't know the exact numbers, but it appears to be, you know, a lot bigger than the existing facility. And the way the ground has changed up there with some of these, you know, Kramer and Russell, this is a major shift, I think, in the way commodities will be moving around that part of the state. The rail capacity, I think, is one of the key things where when we had the rail lines being rolled up in parts of North Dakota, there used to be a line over to Souris and some other areas that those have been abandoned quite a few years ago. So Botno is the end of the line for the rail facility. So my guess tells me that's tied into this, too, where you're going to be able to get people move their products to these two large, this large facility and the existing facility to get in the rail lines to move down.
And on the last thing about the city of Granville,
yes,
the way I understand it, you say Granville really has only a couple options: A, improve what they got, or B, contract with an MDU or somebody to provide the service.
I think that it comes down to that plus maybe another one. They just closed the whole thing down, and their customers could then become heating load for Otter Tail, or if there's some other gas provider that could serve them. But I think that's really what it comes down to is three different options. And I think the discussion I picked up from the mayor yesterday was, you know, they understand it, but what, to Commissioner Crispin's point of trying to get their electorate, if you will, that what is the cost going to be? And, you know, they may have to look at a fixed cost to run this plant because they can't do it and what the cost, used, the budget used to be 10 years ago. And one of their largest customers is the school. And so there's a lot of dynamics at play that don't necessarily affect our order.
One thing we did offer to them as well is some assistance in working through rates. It's not something we regulate them for, but they can certainly lean on some of our staff expertise for how to develop rates and come up with a fixed charge that the customers could pay to help, cover the cost of service to the home and then, you know, usage on top of that. And so they seemed interested in taking advantage of some of that expertise, too, to come up with a more viable long-term financing system for this through rates.
One thing, too, Dave, the closest house to this facility is the mayor's house. Mm-hmm. And he made that very clear to us several times. So I really sense that the mayor's, this is one of his priorities right now.
With regard to the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the cultural survey, the in-person route survey or field survey, was the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe invited to take part in that, or did they or did they not?
You know, I do have in their application materials there's a whole section on consultation, and there's a section that describes their consultation with Standing Rock. In September 2014, Dakota Access met with representatives of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Dakota Access also met with the Tribal Historic Preservation Office of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in October of 2014 to discuss issues of Standing Rock THPO, so their historic preservation officer, may have with the Dakota Access project. Dakota Access shared information regarding the preliminary plans for the project and the methodologies being employed to conduct cultural resource investigations. Dakota Access was informed that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe DHPO has not engaged with federal agencies in the establishment or execution of programmatic agreements regarding cultural resource investigations, and that the tribe will participate in complete Section 106 consultations with federal permitting agencies. Discussion of cooperative cultural resource investigations between Dakota Access Archaeological Field Crews and THPO-sanctioned tribal monitors was initiated. So I know those kinds of conversations existed. And how they evolved, you'd have to talk to Dakota Access and the tribes to determine what invitations were not extended. It sounds to me like cooperative cultural resource investigations between Dakota Access Archaeological Field Crews and the THPO sanctioned tribal monitors was initiated. So they talked about it. According to what they filed with us, they talked about it and how that evolved and resulted in their participation. I can't tell you, but the SHPO might have more information about that as well.
When you said that that with regard to the unanticipated discovery plan, you know, that could the company violate that, you know, they could, but that would be a violation. You guys would take that seriously. And you said to this, those sort of occurrences haven't happened on this line yet. How do you guys know that? Do you have an inspector out there?
We do have inspectors. We have our third-party construction inspectors out there. Mm-hmm. And there are also environmental monitors out there watching for these sorts of things. And so if the company doesn't report us and one of those, they're not there 24/7, but one of those spot inspectors catches it, then we find out of it, they report it. I guess we're also experiencing some given back and forth with the company where there has been on, maybe not on this line in particular, but in other lines where they have come across some issues, they've stopped, they brought in the cultural resources, and they've filed with us, and the experts have examined, and the appropriate policy has been followed. So we get reports from citizens, and they're checked out. That's happened, and that was checked out as well. So it's a give and take. I mean, we don't have the funding to have somebody walking with the construction crews 24/7. So we use what we can and maximize the ability of our third-party inspectors for those purposes.
The third-party inspectors, who are those hired by?
They're hired by us. Okay. Yep. They apply here. They're interviewed and go through the RFP process, and they're secured, and they are in there's a meeting held, a pre-construction conference call held. You guys would be welcome to sit in on one of those sometime if you'd like, because they go through the entire order. They go through our penalties. They go through what permits are required. And all of that is reviewed with the third-party construction inspector, the contractors, and us. So everybody's on the same page about what the expectations are from the get-go. And then we're in pretty close contact with that third-party monitor.
And the environmental monitors, who are those also hired third parties?
The company has environmental monitors that they hire themselves. Our third-party construction person monitors or contractor monitors for the archaeological and the environmental.
Okay. If I could just add.
And one more thing, they bring in experts as needed for the archaeological side of things.
Just to add one more perspective, I guess. Commissioner Fedorchak talked about the 2014 discussion. We held three hearings in 2015. We can't lose sight of that. That's still the time if there was concerns about our order that they should have come to those hearings and brought those concerns. The consultation that happened between the different groups and the Corps of Engineers, that's not our jurisdiction, and that's, I think, the gist of what's going on here. But I think that there's plenty of opportunities for the tribe to exercise their rights and concerns about things that they need to follow in a lawful manner.
Were they invited to the three hearings in 2015?
Everyone was invited to the three hearings in 2015 with a specific notice to the Scott Davis, the North Dakota Commissioner of Indian Affairs, which I know he talked to the individual tribes. So this part about people not being invited, everyone's been invited with a specific invite to the North Dakota Commissioner of Indian Affairs.
And on top of that, you all are aware of the media coverage that occurred regarding those hearings. There was extensive media coverage before, during, and after each one of those hearings. And we had purposely three different hearings at three different locations over the course of 6 weeks. So if by chance you missed one, you could certainly key in on another one. And furthermore, if the tribe had missed them and said, we have issues, I would have made every effort as a portfolio holder to develop another opportunity for them to come forward and talk and share their concerns. We've done that in other hearings or in other cases and taken late filed testimony, and we would have had the opportunity to review that and consider that as well. So you know, it was a 13-month review process, and unfortunately those, you know, the tribe's concerns were not incorporated in that review process for whatever reason. So, you know, how can that be addressed now? How can those concerns be addressed now? I continue to believe that protesting and violence are not the only way to incorporate concerns, even at this point. There must be a better, more productive way to address these issues and get to the bottom of the issues and move on. Now, that's assuming that the ultimate goal isn't just to shut the entire pipeline down. If that's the ultimate goal, then this is the path towards that. But if the ultimate goal is to try to come up with a reasonable way to move forward with this project, addressing these specific concerns that I believe have already been addressed but can be addressed further, if something's been missed or if there's additional assurances that can be made, then let's do that and move forward peacefully in a productive manner before kids or moms or security guards or anybody else is hurt or, God forbid, killed in this protest.
I would even further add that I think, and I've maintained this in the beginning, that the tribe's concerns were addressed because we addressed them. We were very concerned about pipeline safety in the river crossing, the horizontal drill, the extra shutoff valve. So the concerns about water quality, water safety, those were our concerns as well. The cultural review, those are also our concerns. While we asked for the Class 1 study, the Class 2, the 500 sites identified, our additional discussion with them, making them consult with the SHPO. So the concerns that are being brought up are concerns that we had. And so that is the process, and I strongly believe we have a very solid order. We address the concerns. We have a plan in place, and that's the way you do business. Now, as this thing plays out in the courts, the judge has the decision. If he feels that the review was appropriate, then law and order needs to follow. If he feels the review was not appropriate, then he'll say what needs to be addressed, and then they'll go through and they'll address those concerns. But the point of NEPA is to not stop development. It's to understand the outcomes of development. I did over 200 projects with NEPA when I was in the Marine Corps, and you have your environmental assessments, you have your CADEXs, and you have your full EISs. If you have to go to a full EIS, that means there's something you can't mitigate, and then you have to offset it. When we went through the wind farms with Basin Electric south of Minot, there was a full-blown EIS that there was impact potentially to the whipping cranes that the company had to mitigate. So they bought land in a different spot, and they mitigated those concerns. So I think the folks need to understand that even if the judge does say we want more review, that'll be for a specific area, that at the end of the day the EIS will call to mitigate it, but the process says you can build things in the United States if you follow the law. And I think that's one thing that needs to be reinforced. Even if the judge says we want more study, there'll be a process then to study. There'll be a result of the EIS that'll be signed. The company may or may not have to mitigate something, but the goal of NEPA is to build things and know the outcome, not to stop development.
A couple points I just want to throw in here. It wasn't just that we had three hearings, and it's not like they were all up in Williston or somewhere. One of those hearings was in Mandan, you know, a fairly convenient location for people in this area that's being protested to get to. The other thing I want to point out, and it strays a little, but it gets to the point of what can happen in a project like this. In my home area of Mercer County, our courthouse happens to be in Stanton, right near the the Indian villages and some of the most important cultural resources around the state. And they're doing a big building project, and you can say it's fortunate or unfortunate. You know, you take your choice. What's happened is they're in a hold, and it's going to cost the county some extra money and a time delay, but they have run into some very important cultural resources. And according to Hayes and Star editor Daniel Ahrens' article, these are some very, very significant finds that they've made having to do with when the natives were using metal tools and things such as that. And none of this stuff would be known if it weren't for the building project. It would continue to be buried down there under the parking lot of the existing courthouse or exactly wherever it's at. But the fact that there's a construction project that is being monitored and watching for these sorts of things has led to the ability to retrieve this information. And I frankly think it's very useful that it has occurred. Like I say, it's caused the delay and the time cost overrun, but it's some pretty valuable information they've discovered, and that could be the case south of Mandan as well.
The existing pipe. It's in the ground and the reclamation of it. If something goes wrong.
Go ahead.
Well, it's not my thing. You've mentioned it before. So, any other questions?
Based on the way this has all played out, is there anything that you wish you could have done differently or that you might change going into the future in terms of how you interact with the tribes throughout the process?
I think we have a really solid process, and we've used it for many, many years successfully. And we're also very, really serious about wanting public input and wanting the public to attend the hearings. So we have already gone above and beyond to try to get the public to know about our hearings and to attend the hearings and to know that that's their chance to say their piece. And we'll continue to look for any ways we can incorporate to improve upon that and to provide greater public input. Absolutely. That's a process is never perfect. It can always be improved on.
And do you know if any inspectors were at the sites over the weekend or had previously inspected the sites over the weekend? Do you have that information?
I do not.
To find out if they had?
I do not have that information, but Julie might.
One of the things I want to add that should have maybe added before is the, I don't remember exactly if it was 4 years ago, 3 years ago, but we were contacted by the SHPO to do our best to make sure that the actual contents of these artifacts were protected. There was a time when they would we would know exactly what the artifact was and where the location was, and so the SHPO said, you know, it'd be better if we maintain the exact what it is, and you come, we'll come back and say we agree with this, you know, we approve this corridor, the SHPO letter of concurrence, and so we wanted to make sure that all these artifacts are protected. So based on that change in policy, like if someone wants to know exactly where one of these 509 artifacts is at, we won't know, have the location, because once we receive it, it becomes public information, and there was a concern about people, you know, evildoers damning these artifacts. And so we don't have the specifics of what it is at each site, and that's where I really encourage you to go talk to the SHPO and get a feel for the ongoing discussion that takes place between a company when they go through and identify these individual potential artifacts, the process where the SHPO and they determine what it is, and then how that information is then held by the SHPO. If someone wants the information from the SHPO, I believe they have a process where they can sign a non-disclosure and they'll release to them where it is. But everyone in the state has done a really nice job, I think, of trying to make sure we find these artifacts, we protect them, and we understand what it is they bring to the table.
Just occurred to me, all this discussion, I know the whole press corps knows this, but for people who are listening to the broadcast who don't work with this stuff as frequently as you all, SHPO is a State Historic Preservation Office. So,
if there's a violation, what's the process? What remedies do you guys take? What happens?
We have a whole process in place where our staff will investigate it and determine whether there's merits to whatever the claims are, and then they'll provide a recommendation for moving forward. And we have fining authority. Pat, you want to remind us what the specific fining authority might be for a violation of our permit?
I don't have the specific numbers.
Is it the general 200,000 up, maximum 200,000 per day per violation or something like that? We'll have to check on the details, but we have some pretty sizable fines that can be levied.
Someone can forward that or whatnot to us. That would be helpful. Yeah, or if it's printable or whatever. Yeah.
But the process, as Commissioner Fedorchak laid out, is pretty cut and dried. Someone files a complaint. The staff does a review of it. They make a recommendation to it. But as of right now, to my knowledge, unless something changes morning, we've received nothing from the tribe ever. We received individual tribal members, perhaps, that had concerns over the past and different things since August 23rd, but we still haven't received anything at all.
I mean, officially from the tribe?
That's correct. On anything. And that doesn't seem to come out. But they've never talked to us, even after all this discussion. And in August 23rd was the first time we received a letter from anyone, and that I believe this member was a tribal member, but he didn't identify it in his concerns. But we have never heard from the tribe officially.
No.
That's a key point to me.
You said that you'd be open to maybe meeting with the tribe and doing whatever you could going forward. So would you have a meeting with Chairman Archambault and other tribal leaderships? And what specifically at this point could be changed? What could you do to help reach some sort of agreement?
Actually, I think at this point, any sort of a change would have to come between the company and the tribe, and I think that they would have to be able to come up with some sort of settlement of the issues and an agreement for what might be added or done in addition to what's already been committed to. And I agree with Commissioner Kalk. Our review is very thorough, and I'm very comfortable with the safeguards that are in place and the process that's in place on the construction of this line for the protection of the cultural resources and the protection of the water crossing. But, you know, are there additional measures that the tribe could request for monitoring on the pipeline or having the tribal SHPO on site for the actual construction? I mean, those seem to me like I'm a pragmatic person. Those seem to me to be specific things that the tribe might want that the company could say, sure, we'd agree to that. But at this point, our process is over, and that kind of a negotiation needs to occur between the company and the tribe.
Well, then I think it's hard for the average citizen to fully understand the different jurisdictions where our order does a certain thing. But the thing that's really at play now is the Corps of Engineers review. And that's our review is completed, and I'm very confident with it. We've done the right things. We have the right provisions in place. But that's where I think the judge's decision is really going to be big. If the judge determines that the review is adequate, then construction needs to continue. If the judge reviews it's not, he will say what's not, and then that'll need to be addressed. But the focus now is that law and order needs to be followed. Whatever the judge says needs to be upheld, and let this thing play out. But it's the Corps of Engineers review right now with the tribes and others is what's at play. It's not our review. Our order was voted on January of 16. The appeal period is long since passed. We've reviewed it, and there's nothing in our order that I would do differently. We have a solid order. We have a solid process. The questions that I'm hearing out there in media that are being brought up, I ask those questions. We ask those questions. If you're going to move product by pipeline, this is a safe pipeline.
You asked earlier about the third-party inspection process, and that was a process that we beefed up for this project. We did that with this project in mind, knowing the size and the length and the impact that it was going to have in our state. And you might remember, we asked for an additional fee from the company to cover the cost of that contract because the contract was twice as high as most of our construction inspection contracts are. We had to go to the Emergency Commission to get authority to do that. And so we did go some extra, take some extra measures here to provide more oversight, and we are definitely taking advantage of that oversight. We are in regular communication with the third-party construction inspectors.
all these things keep popping in my head. I've also had we talked about grain elevators back in Botno today. I haven't got calls specifically from folks in Botno, but I've received several phone calls from ag producers that are saying, we want the rails free for ag products, not for oil. And so you've got the ag community also is watching this, where that isn't coming out very much. The ag community wants to get oil in the pipelines to keep their rail capacity, because right now we've got plenty of rail capacity to move things around. But as the oil flow comes back up, if pipelines are not built to meet that need, it'll go back onto rail, and we're going to have the challenges with rail safety that we've experienced in the past as well. So there's many different pieces to this equation.
In terms of penalties, I must have been thinking about a different one that I saw recently. But this is any person who willfully engages in any of the following conduct, and there's a number of them listed. One of them is constructing in violation with an order, is subject to a civil penalty of not to exceed $10,000 for each violation for each day that such violations persist, except that the maximum penalty may not exceed $200,000 for any related series of violations.
Where is that located
at? That is 49-22-21.
I would offer up that the monetary penalty is what Commissioner Fedorchuk said, but speaking for myself, we have the ability to rescind the order. That's the biggest penalty that could be out there.
True.
So that is, to me, the ultimate. We have the ability to rescind a siting certificate.
Anything else? Okay, thanks. All right, then we will adjourn for 10 minutes and come back at 11:40 for the admin portion of the meeting. Thanks, everyone.